bedlam of meadowlarks and redwings, and soon you may hear it, the flight song of the upland plover, just now back from the Argentine. If your eyes are strong, you may search the sky and see him, wings a-quiver, circling among the woolly clouds. If your eyes are weak, don't try it. Just watch the fence posts. Soon a flash of silver will tell you on which post the plover has alighted and folded his long wings. Whoever invented the word grace must have seen the wing folding of the plover. There he sits. His whole being says it's your next move to absent yourself from his domain. The county records may allege that you own this pasture, but the plover airily rules out such trivial legalities. He has just flown 4,000 miles to reassert the title he got from the Indians, and until the young plovers are a wing, this pasture is his, and none may trespass without his protest. Somewhere nearby, the hen plover is brooding the 4 large pointed eggs, which will shortly hatch 4 precocial chicks. From the moment their drown is dry, they scamper through the grass like mice on stilts, quite able to elude your clumsy efforts to catch them. At 30 days, the chicks are full grown. No other fowl develops with equal speed. By August, they have graduated from flying school, and on cool August nights, you can hear their whistled signals as they set wing for the pampas, to prove again the age-old unity of the Americas. Hemisphere solidarity is new among statesmen, but not among the feathered navies of the sky. The upland plover fits easily into the agricultural countryside. He follows the black and white buffalo, which now pasture his prairies, and finds them an acceptable substitute for brown ones. He nests in hay fields as well as pastures, but, unlike the clumsy pheasant, does not get caught in hay mowers. Well before the hay is ready to cut, the young plovers are a wing and away. In farm country, the plover has only 2 real enemies, the gully and the drainage ditch. Perhaps we shall one day find that these are our enemies, too. There was a time in the early 1900s when Wisconsin farms nearly lost their immemorial timepiece, when May pastures greened in silence, and August nights brought no whistled reminder of impending fall. Universal gunpowder, plus the lure of plover on toast for post-Victorian banquets, had taken too great a toll. The belated protection of the federal migratory bird laws came just in time. June. The Alder Fork, a fishing idol. We found the main stream so low that the teeter snipe pattered about in what last year were trout riffles, and so warm that we could duck in its deepest pool without a shout. Even after our cooling swim, waders felt like hot tar paper in the sun. The evening's fishing proved as disappointing as its auguries. We asked that stream for trout, and it gave us a chub. That night we sat under a mosquito smudge and debated the morrow's plan. 200 miles of hot, dusty road we had come, to feel again the impetuous tug of a disillusioned brook or rainbow. There were no trout. But this, we now remembered, was a stream of parts. High up near the headwaters, we had once seen a fork, narrow, deep, and fed by cold springs that gurgled out under its close-hemmed walls of alder. What would a self-respecting trout do in such weather? Just what we did. Go up. In the fresh of the morning, when 100 whitethroats had forgotten it would ever again be anything but sweet and cool, I climbed down the dewy bank and stepped into the alder fork. A trout was rising just upstream. I paid out some line, wishing it would always stay thus soft and dry, and measuring the distance with a false cast or two, laid down a spent gnat exactly a foot above his last swirl. Forgotten now were the hot miles, the mosquitoes, the ignominious chub. He took it with one great gulp, and shortly I could hear him kicking in the bed of wet alder leaves at the bottom of the creel. Another, albeit larger, fish had meanwhile risen in the next pool, which lay at the very head of navigation, for at its upper end the alders closed in solid phalanx. One bush, with its brown stem laved in the middle current, shook with a perpetual silent laughter, as if to mock at any fly that gods or men might cast 1 inch beyond its outermost leaf. For the duration of a cigarette, I sit on a rock midstream, and watch my trout rise under his guardian bush, while my rod and line hang drying on the alders of the sunny bank. Then, for prudence sake, a little longer. That pool is too smooth up there. A breeze is stirring, and may shortly ruffle it for an instant, and thus make more deadly that perfect cast I shall shortly lay upon its bosom. It will come, a puff strong enough to shake a brown miller off the laughing alder, and cast it upon the pool. Ready now. Coil up the dry line and stand midstream, rod in instant readiness. It's coming. A little premonitory shiver in that aspen on the hill lets me get out half a cast, and swish it gently back and forth, ready for the main puff to hit the pool. No more than half a line, mind you. The sun is high now, and any flicking shadow overhead would forewarn my hunker of his impending fate. Now! The last 3 yards shoot out, and the fly falls gracefully at the feet of the laughing alder. He has it. I set hard to hold him out of the jungle beyond. He rushes downstream. In a few minutes, he, too, is kicking in the creel. I sit in happy meditation on my rock, pondering, while my line dries again, upon the ways of trout and men. How like fish we are, ready, nay, eager, to seize upon whatever new thing some wind of circumstance shakes down upon the river of time. And how we rue our haste, finding the gilded morsel to contain a hook. Even so, I think there is some virtue in eagerness, whether its object prove true or false. How utterly dull would be a wholly prudent man, or trout, or world! Did I say a while ago that I waited for prudence's sake? That was not so. The only prudence in fishermen is that designed to set the stage for taking yet another, and perhaps a longer, chance. Time to be at it now. They will soon stop rising. I wade waist-deep to head of navigation, poke my head insolently into the shaking alder, and look within. Jungle is right. A coal-black hole above, so canopied in greenness you could not wave a fern, much less a rod, above its rushing depths. And there, almost rubbing his ribs against the dark bank, a great trout rolls lazily over as he sucks down a passing bug. Not a chance to stalk him, even with a lowly worm. But 20 yards above, I see bright sunshine on the water. Another opening. Fish a dry fly downstream? It cannot, but it must be done. I retreat and climb the bank. Neck deep in jewelweed and nettles, I detour through the alder thicket to the opening above. With cat-like care not to roil His Majesty's bath, I step in and stand stock still for 5 minutes to let things calm down. The while, I strip out, oil, dry, and coil upon my left hand 30 feet of line. I am that far above the portal to the jungle. Now for the long chance. I blow upon my fly to give it one last fluff, lay it on the stream at my feet, and quickly pay out coil after coil. Then, just as the line straightens out and the fly is sucked into the jungle, I walk quickly downstream, straining my eyes into the dark vault to follow its fortunes. A fleeting glimpse or two as it passes a speck of sunlight shows it still rides clear. It rounds the bend. In no time, long before the royal of my walking has betrayed the ruse, it reaches the black pool. I hear, rather than see, the rush of the great fish. I set hard, and the battle is on. No prudent man would risk a dollar's worth of fly and leader pulling a trout upstream through the giant toothbrush of alder stems comprising the bend of that creek. But, as I said, no prudent man is a fisherman. By and by, with much cautious unraveling, I got him up into open water, and finally aboard the creel. I shall now confess to you that none of those 3 trout had to be beheaded, or folded double, to fit their casket. What was big was not the trout, but the chance. What was full was not my creel, but my memory. Like the whitethroats, I had forgotten it would ever again be aught but mourning on the fork. July. Great Possessions. 120 acres, according to the county clerk, is the extent of my worldly domain. but the county clerk is a sleepy fellow who never looks at his record books before 9 o'clock. What they would show at daybreak is the question here at issue. Book or no books, it is a fact, patent both to my dog and myself, that at daybreak I am the sole owner of all the acres I can walk over. It is not only boundaries that disappear, but also the thought of being bounded. Expanses unknown to deed or map are known to every dawn, and solitude, supposed no longer to exist in my county, extends on every hand as far as the dew can reach. Like other great landowners, I have tenants. They are negligent about rents, but very punctilious about tenures. Indeed, at every daybreak from April to July, they proclaim their boundaries to each other, and so acknowledge, at least by inference, their fiefdom to me. This daily ceremony, contrary to what you might suppose, begins with the utmost decorum. Who originally laid down its protocols, I do not know. At 3:30 a.m., with such dignity as I can muster of a July morning, I step from my cabin door, bearing in either hand my emblems of sovereignty, a coffee pot and notebook. I seat myself on a bench, facing the white wake of the morning star. I set the pot beside me. I extract a cup from my shirt front, hoping none will notice its informal mode of transport. I get out my watch, pour coffee, and lay notebook on knee. This is the cue for the proclamations to begin. At 3:35, the nearest field sparrow avows, in a clear tenor chant, that he holds the jackpine copse north to the riverbank, and south to the old wagon track. One by one, all the other field sparrows within earshot recite their respective holdings. There are no disputes, at least at this hour, so I just listen, hoping inwardly that their womenfolk acquiesce in this happy accord over the status quo ante. Before the field sparrows have quite gone the rounds, the robin in the big elm warbles loudly his claim to the crotch where the ice storm tore off a limb, and all appurtenances pertaining thereto, meaning, in his case, all the angleworms in the not very spacious subjacent lawn. The robin's insistent caroling awakens the oriole, who now tells the world of orioles that the pendant branch of the elm belongs to him, together with all the fiber-bearing milkweed stalks nearby, all loose strings in the garden, and the exclusive right to flash like a burst of fire from one of these to another. My watch says 3:50. The indigo bunting on the hill asserts title to the dead oak limb left by the 1936 drought, and to divers nearby bugs and bushes. He does not claim, but I think he implies, the right to out-blue all bluebirds and all spiderworts that have turned their faces to the dawn. Next, the wren, the one who discovered the knothole in the eave of the cabin, explodes into song. Half a dozen other wrens give voice, and now all is bedlam. Grosbeaks, thrashers, yellow warblers, bluebirds, vireos, towhees, cardinals, all are at it. My solemn list of performers, in their order and time of first song, hesitates, wavers, ceases, for my ear can no longer filter out priorities. Besides, my pot is empty, and the sun is about to rise. I must inspect my domain before my title runs out. We sally forth, the dog and I, at random. He has paid scant respect to all these vocal goings-on, for to him the evidence of tenantry is not song, but scent. Any illiterate bundle of feathers, he says, can make a noise in a tree. Now he is going to translate for me the olfactory poems that who knows what silent creatures have written in the summer night. At the end of each poem sits the author, if we can find him. What we actually find is beyond predicting. A rabbit, suddenly yearning to be elsewhere, a woodcock, fluttering his disclaimer, a cock-pheasant, indignant over wetting his feathers in the grass. Once in a while we turn up a coon or mink, returning late from the night's foray. Sometimes we rout a heron from his unfinished fishing, or surprise a mother wood duck with her convoy of ducklings, headed full steam for the shelter of the pickerel weeds. Sometimes we see deer sauntering back to the thickets, replete with alfalfa blooms, veronica, and wild lettuce. More often we see only the interweaving, darkened lines that lazy hoofs have traced on the silken fabric of the dew. I can feel the sun now. The bird chorus has run out of breath. The far clank of cowbells bespeaks a herd ambling to pasture. A tractor roars warning that my neighbor is astir. The world has shrunk to those mean dimensions known to county clerks. We turn toward home and breakfast. Prairie Birthday. During every week from April to September, there are, on the average, 10 wild plants coming into first bloom. In June, as many as a dozen species may burst their buds on a single day. No man can heed all of these anniversaries. No man can ignore all of them. He who steps unseeing on May dandelions may be hauled up short by August ragweed pollen. He who ignores the ruddy haze of April elms may skid his car on the fallen corollas of June catalpas. Tell me of what plant birthday a man takes notice, and I shall tell you a good deal about his vocation, his hobbies, his hay fever, and the general level of his ecological education. Every July, I watch eagerly a certain country graveyard that I pass in driving to and from my farm. It is time for a prairie birthday, and in one corner of this graveyard lives a surviving celebrant of that once important event. It is an ordinary graveyard, bordered by the usual spruces and studded with the usual pink granite or white marble headstones, each with the usual Sunday bouquet of red or pink geraniums. It is extraordinary only in being triangular instead of square, and in harboring, within the sharp angle of its fence, a pinpoint remnant of the native prairie on which the graveyard was established in the 1840s. Heretofore unreachable by scythe or mower, this yard-square relic of original Wisconsin gives birth, each July, to a man-high stalk of compass plant or cut-leaf silphium, spangled with saucer-sized yellow blooms resembling sunflowers. It is the sole remnant of this plant along this highway, and perhaps the sole remnant in the western half of our country. What 1,000 acres of silphiums looked like when they tickled the bellies of the buffalo is a question never again to be answered, and perhaps not even asked. This year I found the silphium in first bloom on 24th July, a week later than usual. During the last 6 years, the average date was 15th July. When I passed the graveyard again on 3rd August, the fence had been removed by a road crew, and the silphium cut. It is easy now to predict the future. For a few years, my silphium will try in vain to rise above the mowing machine, and then it will die. With it will die the prairie epic. The highway department says that 100,000 cars pass yearly over this route during the 3 summer months when the silphium is in bloom. In them must ride at least 100,000 people who have taken what is called history, and perhaps 25,000 who have taken what is called botany. Yet I doubt whether a dozen have seen the silphium, and of these, hardly one will notice its demise. If I were to tell a preacher of the adjoining church that the road crew has been burning history books in his cemetery under the guise of mowing weeds, he would be amazed and uncomprehending. How could a weed be a book? This is one little episode in the funeral of the native flora, which in turn is one episode in the funeral of the floras of the world. Mechanized man, oblivious of floras, is proud of his progress in cleaning up the landscape on which, willy-nilly, he must live out his days. It might be wise to prohibit at once all teaching of real botany and real history, lest some future citizen suffer qualms about the floristic price of his good life. Thus it comes to pass that farm neighborhoods are good in proportion to the poverty of their floras. My own farm was selected for its lack of goodness and its lack of highway. Indeed, my whole neighborhood lies in a backwash of the river progress. My road is the original wagon track of the pioneers, innocent of grades or gravel, brushings or bulldozers. My neighbors bring a sigh to the county agent. Their fence rows go unshaven for years on end. Their marshes are neither diked nor drained. As between going fishing and going forward, they are prone to prefer fishing. Thus, on weekends, my floristic standard of living is that of the backwoods, while on weekdays I subsist as best I can on the flora of the university farms, the university campus, and the adjoining suburbs. For a decade I have kept, for pastime, a record of the wild plant species in first bloom on these two diverse areas. Species first blooming in April, suburb and campus, 14, backward farm, 26. Species first blooming in May, suburb and campus, 29, backward farm, 59. Species first blooming in June, suburb and campus, 43, backward farm, 70. Species first blooming in July, suburb and campus, 25, backward farm, 56. Species first blooming in August, suburb and campus, 9, backward farm, 14. Species first blooming in September, suburb and campus, 0, backward farm, 1. Total visual diet, suburb and campus, 120. Backward farm, 226. It is apparent that the backward farmer's eye is nearly twice as well fed as the eye of the university student or businessman. Of course, neither sees his flora as yet, so we are confronted by the two alternatives already mentioned. Either ensure the continued blindness of the populace, or examine the question whether we cannot have both progress and plants. The shrinkage in the flora is due to a combination of clean farming, woodlot grazing, and good roads. Each of these necessary changes, of course, requires a larger reduction in the acreage available for wild plants, but none of them requires, or benefits by, the erasure of species from whole farms, townships, or counties. There are idle spots on every farm, and every highway is bordered by an idle strip as long as it is. Keep cow, plow, and mower out of these idle spots, and the full native flora, plus dozens of interesting stowaways from foreign parts, could be part of the normal environment of every citizen. The outstanding conservator of the prairie flora, ironically enough, knows little and cares less about such frivolities. It is the railroad with its fenced right-of-way. Many of these railroad fences were erected before the prairie had been plowed. Within these linear reservations, oblivious of cinders, soot, and annual cleanup fires, the prairie flora still splashes its calendar of colors, from pink shooting star in May to blue aster in October. I have long wished to confront some hard-boiled railway president with the physical evidence of his soft-heartedness. I have not done so because I haven't met one. The railroads, of course, use flamethrowers and chemical sprays to clear the track of weeds, but the cost of such necessary clearance is still too high to extend it much beyond the actual rails. Perhaps further improvements are in the offing. The erasure of a human subspecies is largely painless, to us, if we know little enough about it. A dead Chinaman is of little import to us, whose awareness of things Chinese is bounded by an occasional dish of chow mein. We grieve only for what we know. The erasure of silphium from Western Dane County is no cause for grief if one knows it only as a name in a botany book. Silphium first became a personality to me when I tried to dig one up to move to my farm. It was like digging an oak sapling. After half an hour of hot, grimy labor, the root was still enlarging, like a great vertical sweet potato. As far as I know, that silphium root went clear through to bedrock. I got no silphium, but I learned by what elaborate underground stratagems it contrives to weather the prairie droughts. I next planted silphium seeds, which are large, meaty, and taste like sunflower seeds. They came up promptly, but after 5 years of waiting, the seedlings are still juvenile, and have not yet borne a flower stalk. Perhaps it takes a decade for a silphium to reach flowering age. How old, then, was my pet plant in the cemetery? It may have been older than the oldest tombstone, which is dated 1850. Perhaps it watched the fugitive Black Hawk retreat from the Madison Lakes to the Wisconsin River. It stood on the root of that famous march. Certainly it saw the successive funerals of the local pioneers as they retired, one by one, to their repose beneath the blue stem. I once saw a power shovel, while digging a roadside ditch, sever the sweet potato root of a silphium plant. The root soon sprouted new leaves, and eventually it again produced a flower stalk. This explains why this plant, which never invades new ground, is nevertheless sometimes seen on recently graded roadsides. Once established, it apparently withstands almost any kind of mutilation except continued grazing, mowing, or plowing. Why does silphium disappear from grazed areas? I once saw a farmer turn his cows into a virgin prairie meadow, previously used only sporadically for mowing wild hay. The cows cropped the silphium to the ground before any other plant was visibly eaten at all. One can imagine that the buffalo once had the same preference for silphium, but he brooked no fences to confine his nibblings all summer long to one meadow. In short, the buffalo's pasturing was discontinuous and therefore tolerable to silphium. It is a kind providence that has withheld the sense of history from the thousands of species of plants and animals that have exterminated each other to build the present world. The same kind providence now withholds it from us. Few grieved when the last buffalo left Wisconsin, and few will grieve when the last silphium follows him to the lush prairies of the Never-Never Land. August. The Green Pasture. Some paintings become famous because, being durable, they are viewed by successive generations, in each of which are likely to be found a few appreciative eyes. I know a painting so evanescent that it is seldom viewed at all, except by some wandering deer. It is a river who wields the brush, and it is the same river who, before I can bring my friends to view his work, erases it forever from human view. After that, it exists only in my mind's eye. Like other artists, my river is temperamental. There is no predicting when the mood to paint will come upon him, or how long it will last. But in midsummer, when the great white fleets cruise the sky for day after flawless day, it is worth strolling down to the sandbars just to see whether he has been at work. The work begins with a broad ribbon of silt brushed thinly on the sand of a receding shore. As this dries slowly in the sun, goldfinches bathe in its pools, and deer, herons, killdeers, raccoons, and turtles cover it with a lacework of tracks. There is no telling, at this stage, whether anything further will happen. But when I see the silt ribbon turning green with Eleocharis, I watch closely thereafter, for this is the sign that the river is in a painting mood. Almost overnight, the Eleocharis becomes a thick turf, so lush and so dense that the meadow mice from the adjoining upland cannot resist the temptation. They move en masse to the green pasture, then apparently spend the nights rubbing their ribs in its velvety depths. A maze of neatly tended mouse trails bespeaks their enthusiasm. The deer walk up and down in it, apparently just for the pleasure of feeling it underfoot. Even a stay-at-home mole has tunneled his way across the dry bar to the Eleocharis ribbon, where he can heave and hump the verdant sod to his heart's content. At this stage, the seedlings of plants too numerous to count and too young to recognize spring to life from the damp, warm sand under the green ribbon. To view the painting, give the river 3 more weeks of solitude, and then visit the bar on some bright morning, just after the sun has melted the daybreak fog. The artist has now laid his colors and sprayed them with dew. The Eleocharis sod, greener than ever, is now spangled with blue mimulus, pink dragonhead, and the milk-white blooms of Sagittaria. Here and there a cardinal flower thrusts a red spear skyward. At the head of the bar, purple ironweeds and pale pink joe pies stand tall against the wall of willows. And if you have come quietly and humbly, as you should to any spot that can be beautiful only once, you may surprise a fox-red deer standing knee-high in the garden of his delight. Do not return for a second view of the green pasture, for there is none. Either falling water has dried it out, or rising water has scoured the bar to its original austerity of clean sand. But in your mind, you may hang up your picture and hope that in some other summer, the mood to paint may come upon the river. September. The Coral Copse. By September, the day breaks with little help from birds. A song sparrow may give a single half-hearted song, A woodcock may twitter overhead en route to his daytime thicket. A barred owl may terminate the night's argument with one last wavering call, but few other birds have anything to say or sing about. It is on some, but not all, of these misty autumn daybreaks that one may hear the chorus of the quail. The silence is suddenly broken by a dozen contralto voices, no longer able to restrain their praise of the day to come. After a brief minute or two, the music closes as suddenly as it began. There is a peculiar virtue in the music of elusive birds. Songsters that sing from topmost boughs are easily seen and as easily forgotten. They have the mediocrity of the obvious. What one remembers is the invisible hermit thrush pouring silver chords from impenetrable shadows, the soaring crane trumpeting from behind a cloud, the prairie chicken booming from the mists of nowhere, the quail's Ave Maria in the hush of dawn. No naturalist has ever seen the choral act, for the covey is still on its invisible roost in the grass, and any attempt to approach automatically induces silence. In June, it is completely predictable that the robin will give voice when the light intensity reaches 0.01 candle power, and that the bedlam of other singers will follow in predictable sequence. In autumn, on the other hand, the robin is silent, and it is quite unpredictable whether the covey chorus will occur at all. The disappointment I feel on these mornings of silence perhaps shows that things hoped for have a higher value than things assured. The hope of hearing quail is worth half a dozen risings in the dark. My farm always has one or more coveys in autumn, but the daybreak chorus is usually distant. I think this is because the coveys prefer to roost as far as possible from the dog, whose interest in quail is even more ardent than my own. One October dawn, however, as I sat sipping coffee by the outdoor fire, a chorus burst into song hardly a stone's throw away. They had roosted under a white pine copse, possibly to stay dry during the heavy dews. We felt honored by this daybreak hymn song almost at our doorstep. Somehow the blue autumnal needles on those pines became thenceforth bluer, and the red carpet of dewberry under those pines became even redder. October. Smoky gold. There are two kinds of hunting, ordinary hunting and ruffed grouse hunting. There are two places to hunt grouse, ordinary places and Adams County. There are two times to hunt in Adams, ordinary times and when the tamaracks are smoky gold. This is written for those luckless ones who have never stood, gun empty and mouth agape, to watch the golden needles come sifting down, while the feathery rocket that knocked them off sails unscathed into the jack pines. The tamaracks change from green to yellow when the first frosts have brought woodcock, fox sparrows, and juncos out of the north. Troops of robins are stripping the last white berries from the dogwood thickets, leaving the empty stems as a pink haze against the hill. The creekside alders have shed their leaves, exposing here and there an eyeful of holly. Brambles are aglow, lighting your footsteps grouseward. The dog knows what is grouseward better than you do. You will do well to follow him closely, reading from the cock of his ears the story the breeze is telling. When at last he stops stock still and says with a sideward glance, "Well, get ready." The question is, ready for what? A twittering woodcock, or the rising roar of a grouse, or perhaps only a rabbit? In this moment of uncertainty is condensed much of the virtue of grouse hunting. He who must know what to get ready for should go and hunt pheasants. Hunts differ in flavor, but the reasons are subtle. The sweetest hunts are stolen. To steal a hunt, either go far into the wilderness where no one has been, or else find some undiscovered place under everybody's nose. Few hunters know that grouse exist in Adams County, for when they drive through it, they see only a waste of jack pines and scrub oaks. This is because the highway intersects a series of west-running creeks, each of which heads in a swamp, but drops to the river through dry sand barrens. Naturally, the northbound highway intersects these swampless barrens, but just above the highway and behind the screen of dry scrub, every creeklet expands into a broad ribbon of swamp, a sure haven for grouse. Here, come October, I sit in the solitude of my tamaracks and hear the hunters' cars roaring up the highway, hell-bent for the crowded counties to the north. I chuckle as I picture their dancing speedometers, their strained faces, their eager eyes glued on the northward horizon. At the noise of their passing, a cock-grouse drums his defiance. My dog grins as we note his direction. That fellow, we agree, needs some exercise. We shall look him up presently. The tamaracks grow not only in the swamp, but at the foot of the bordering upland, where springs break forth. Each spring has become choked with moss, which forms a boggy terrace. I call these terraces the hanging gardens, for out of their sodden muck, the fringed gentians have lifted blue jewels. Such an October gentian, dusted with tamarack gold, is worth a full stop and a long look, even when the dog signals grouse ahead. Between each hanging garden and the creekside is a moss-paved deer trail, handy for the hunter to follow and for the flushed grouse to cross in a split second. The question is whether the bird and the gun agree on how a second should be split. If they do not, the next deer that passes finds a pair of empty shells to sniff at, but no feathers. Higher up the creeklet, I encounter an abandoned farm. I try to read, from the age of the young jackpines marching across an old field, how long ago the luckless farmer found out that sand plains were meant to grow solitude, not corn. Jackpines tell tall tales to the unwary, for they put on several whorls of branches each year instead of only one. I find a better chronometer in an elm seedling that now blocks the barn door. Its rings date back to the drought of 1930. Since that year, no man has carried milk out of this barn. I wonder what this family thought about when their mortgage finally outgrew their crops and thus gave the signal for their eviction. Many thoughts, like flying grouse, leave no trace of their passing, but some leave clues that outlast the decades. He who, in some unforgotten April, planted this lilac must have thought pleasantly of blooms for all the Aprils to come. She who used this washboard, its corrugations worn thin with many Mondays, may have wished for a cessation of all Mondays, and soon. Musing on such questions, I become aware of the dog down by the spring, pointing patiently these many minutes. I walk up, apologizing for my inattention. Up twitters a woodcock, bat-like, his salmon breast soaked in October sun. Thus goes the hunt. It's hard on such a day to keep one's mind on grouse, for there are many distractions. I cross a buck track in the sand and follow in idle curiosity. The track leads straight from one Jersey tea bush to another, with nipped twigs showing why. This reminds me of my own lunch, but before I get it pulled out of my game pocket, I see a circling hawk, high skyward, needing identification. I wait till he banks and shows his red tail. I reach again for the lunch, but my eye catches a peeled popple. Here a buck has rubbed off his itchy velvet. How long ago? The exposed wood is already brown. I conclude that horns must therefore be clean by now. I reach again for the lunch, but am interrupted by an excited yawp from the dog, and a crash of bushes in the swamp. Out springs a buck, flag aloft, horns shining, his coat a sleek blue. Yes, the popple told the truth. This time I get the lunch all the way out and sit down to eat. A chickadee watches me and grows confidential about his lunch. He doesn't say what he ate. Perhaps it was cooled turgid ant eggs or some other avian equivalent of cold roast grouse. Lunch over, I regard a phalanx of young tamaracks, their golden lances thrusting skyward. Under each, the needles of yesterday fall to earth, building a blanket of smoky gold. At the tip of each, the bud of tomorrow, preformed, poised, awaits another spring. Too early. Getting up too early is a vice habitual in horned owls, stars, geese, and freight trains. Some hunters acquire it from geese, and some coffee pots from hunters. It is strange that of all the multitude of creatures who must rise in the morning at some time, only these few should have discovered the most pleasant and least useful time for doing it. Orion must have been the original mentor of the too early company, for it is he who signals for too early rising. It is time when Orion has passed west of the zenith about as far as one should lead a teal. Early risers feel at ease with each other, perhaps because, unlike those who sleep late, they are given to understatement of their own achievements. Orion, the most widely traveled, says literally nothing. The coffee pot, from its first soft gurgle, underclaims the virtues of what simmers within. The owl, in his trisyllabic commentary, plays down the story of the night's murders. The goose on the bar, rising briefly to a point of order in some inaudible anseron debate, lets fall no hint that he speaks with the authority of all the far hills and the sea. The freight, I admit, is hardly reticent about his own importance. Yet even he has a kind of modesty. His eye is single to his own noisy business, and he never comes roaring into somebody else's camp. I feel a deep security in this single-mindedness of freight trains. To arrive too early in the marsh is an adventure in pure listening. The ear roams at will among the noises of the night, without let or hindrance from hand or eye. When you hear a mallard being audibly enthusiastic about his soup, you are free to picture a score guzzling among the duckweeds. When one widgeon squeals, you may postulate a squadron without fear of visual contradiction. And when a flock of bluebills, pitching pondward, tears the dark silk of heaven in one long rending nosedive, you catch your breath at the sound, but there is nothing to see except stars. This same performance, in daytime, would have to be looked at, shot at, missed, and then hurriedly fitted with an alibi. Nor could daylight add anything to your mind's eye picture of quivering wings, ripping the firmament neatly into halves. The hour of listening ends when the fowl depart on muted wings for wider, safer waters, each flock a blur against the graying east. Like many another treaty of restraint, the pre-dawn pact lasts only as long as darkness humbles the arrogant. It would seem as if the sun were responsible for the daily retreat of reticence from the world. At any rate, by the time the mists are white over the lowlands, every rooster is bragging ad lib, and every corn shock is pretending to be twice as tall as any corn that ever grew. By sunup, every squirrel is exaggerating some fancied indignity to his person, and every jaw proclaiming with false emotion about supposititious dangers to society, at this very moment discovered by him. Distant crows are berating a hypothetical owl, just to tell the world how vigilant crows are, and a pheasant cock, musing perhaps on his philanderings of bygone days, beats the air with his wings and tells the world in raucous warning that he owns this marsh and all the hens in it. Nor are all these illusions of grandeur confined to the birds and beasts. By breakfast time come the honks, horns, shouts, and whistles of the awakened farmyard, and finally, at evening, the drone of an untended radio. Then everybody goes to bed to relearn the lessons of the night. Red lanterns. One way to hunt partridge is to make a plan based on logic and probabilities of the terrain to be hunted. This will take you over the ground where the birds ought to be. Another way is to wander, quite aimlessly, from one red lantern to another. This will likely take you where the birds actually are. The lanterns are blackberry leaves, red in October sun. Red lanterns have lighted my way on many a pleasant hunt in many a region, but I think that blackberries must first have learned how to glow in the sand counties of central Wisconsin. Along the little boggy streams of these friendly wastes, called poor by those whose own lights barely flicker, the blackberries burn richly red on every sunny day from first frost to the last day of the season. Every woodcock and every partridge has his private solarium under these briars. Most hunters, not knowing this, wear themselves out in the briarless scrub, and, returning home birdless, leave the rest of us in peace. By us, I mean the birds, the stream, the dog, and myself. The stream is a lazy one. He winds through the alders as if he would rather stay here than reach the river. So would I. Every one of his hairpin hesitations means that much more stream bank, where hillside briars adjoin dank beds of frozen ferns and jewel weeds on the boggy bottom. No partridge can long absent himself from such a place, nor can I. Partridge hunting, then, is a creekside stroll upwind from one briar patch to another. The dog, when he approaches the briars, looks around to make sure I am within gunshot. Reassured, he advances with steady caution, his wet nose screening 100 cents for that 1 cent, the potential presence of which gives life and meaning to the whole landscape. He is the prospector of the air, perpetually searching its strata for olfactory gold. Partridge scent is the gold standard that relates his world to mine. My dog, by the way, thinks I have much to learn about partridges, and, being a professional naturalist, I agree. He persists in tutoring me, with the calm patience of a professor of logic, in the art of drawing deductions from an educated nose. I delight in seeing him deduce a conclusion, in the form of a point, from data that are obvious to him, but speculative to my unaided eye. Perhaps he hopes his dull pupil will one day learn to smell. Like other dull pupils, I know when the professor is right, even though I do not know why. I check my gun and walk in. Like any good professor, the dog never laughs when I miss, which is often. He gives me just one look and proceeds up the stream in quest of another grouse. Following one of these banks, one walks astride two landscapes, the hillside one hunts from, and the bottom the dog hunts in. There is a special charm in treading soft, dry carpets of lycopodium to flush birds out of the bog, and the first test of a partridge dog is his willingness to do the wet work while you parallel him on the dry bank. A special problem arises where the belt of alders widens and the dog disappears from view. Hurry at once to a knoll or point, where you stand stock still, straining eye and ear to follow the dog. A sudden scattering of white throats may reveal his whereabouts. Again you may hear him breaking a twig, or splashing in a wet spot, or plopping into the creek. But when all sound ceases, be ready for instant action, for he is likely on point. Listen now for the premonitory clucks a frightened partridge gives just before flushing. Then follows the hurtling bird, or perhaps two of them, or I have known as many as six, clucking and flushing one by one, each sailing high for his own destination in the uplands. Whether one passes within gunshot is, of course, a matter of chance, and you can compute the chance if you have time. 360 degrees divided by 30, or whatever segment of the circle your gun covers. Divide again by 3 or 4, which is your chance of missing, and you have the probability of actual feathers in the hunting coat. The second test of a good partridge dog is whether he reports for orders after such an episode. Sit down and talk it over with him while he pants. Then look for the next red lantern and proceed with the hunt. The October breeze brings my dog many scents other than grouse, each of which may lead to its own peculiar episode. When he points with a certain humorous expression of the ears, I know he has found a bedded rabbit. Once a dead serious point yielded no bird, but still the dog stood frozen. In a tuft of sedge under his very nose was a fat sleeping coon getting his share of October sun. At least once on each hunt, the dog bays a skunk, usually in some denser-than-ordinary thicket of blackberries. Once the dog pointed in midstream. A whir of wings upriver, followed by 3 musical cries, told me he had interrupted a wood duck's dinner. Not infrequently, he finds jacksnipe in heavily pastured alders, and lastly he may put out a deer, bedded for the day on a high stream bank, flanked by alder bog. Has the deer a poetical weakness for singing waters, or a practical liking for a bed that cannot be approached without making a noise. Judging by the indignant flick of his great white flag, it might be either, or both. Almost anything may happen between one red lantern and another. At sunset, on the last day of the grouse season, every blackberry blows out his light. I do not understand how a mere bush can thus be infallibly informed about the Wisconsin statutes, nor have I ever gone back next day to find out. For the ensuing 11 months, the lanterns glow only in recollection. I sometimes think that the other months were constituted mainly as a fitting interlude between Octobers, and I suspect that dogs, and perhaps grouse, share the same view. November. If I Were the Wind. The wind that makes music in November corn is in a hurry. The stalks hum, the loose husks whisk skyward in half-playful swirls, and the wind hurries on. In the marsh, long windy waves surge across the grassy sloughs, beat against the far willows. A tree tries to argue, bare limbs waving, but there is no detaining the wind. On the sandbar, there is only wind, and the river sliding seaward. Every wisp of grass is drawing circles on the sand. I wander over the bar to a driftwood log, where I sit and listen to the universal roar and to the tinkle of wavelets on the shore. The river is lifeless. Not a duck, heron, marsh hawk, or gull but has sought refuge from wind. Out of the clouds I hear a faint bark, as of a faraway dog. It is strange how the world cocks its ears at that sound, wondering. Soon it is louder, the honk of geese, invisible, but coming on. The flock emerges from the low clouds, a tattered banner of birds dipping and rising, blown up and blown down, blown together and blown apart, but advancing, the wind wrestling lovingly with each winnowing wing. When the flock is a blur in the far sky, I hear the last honk, sounding taps for summer. It is warm behind the driftwood now, for the wind is gone with the geese. So would I, if I were the wind. Axe in hand. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away, but he is no longer the only one to do so. When some remote ancestor of ours invented the shovel, he became a giver. He could plant a tree. And when the axe was invented, he became a taker. He could chop it down. Whoever owns land has thus assumed, whether he knows it or not, the divine functions of creating and destroying plants. Other ancestors, less remote, have since invented other tools, but each of these, upon close scrutiny, proves to be either an elaboration of, or an accessory to, the original pair of basic implements. We classify ourselves into vocations, each of which either wields some particular tool, or sells it, or repairs it, or sharpens it, or dispenses advice on how to do so. By such division of labors, we avoid responsibility for the misuse of any tool save our own. But there is one vocation, philosophy, which knows that all men, by what they think about and wish for, in effect wield all tools. It knows that men thus determine, by their manner of thinking and wishing, whether it is worthwhile to wield any. November is, for many reasons, the month for the axe. It is warm enough to grind an axe without freezing, but cold enough to fell a tree in comfort. The leaves are off the hardwoods, so that one can see just how the branches intertwine and what growth occurred last summer. Without this clear view of treetops, one cannot be sure which tree, if any, needs felling for the good of the land. I have read many definitions of what is a conservationist, and written not a few myself, but I suspect that the best one is written not with a pen, but with an axe. It is a matter of what a man thinks about while chopping, or while deciding what to chop. A conservationist is one who is humbly aware that with each stroke he is writing his signature on the face of his land. Signatures, of course, differ, whether written with an axe or pen, and this is as it should be. I find it disconcerting to analyze, ex post facto, the reasons behind my own axe-in-hand decisions. I find, first of all, that not all trees are created free and equal. where a white pine and a red birch are crowding each other, I have an a priori bias. I always cut the birch to favor the pine. Why? Well, first of all, I planted the pine with my shovel, whereas the birch crawled in under the fence and planted itself. My bias is thus to some extent paternal, but this cannot be the whole story, for if the pine were a natural seedling like the birch, I would value it even more. So I must dig deeper for the logic, if any, behind my bias. The birch is an abundant tree in my township, and becoming more so, whereas pine is scarce and becoming scarcer. Perhaps my bias is for the underdog. But what would I do if my farm were further north, where pine is abundant and red birch is scarce? I confess I don't know. My farm is here. The pine will live for a century, the birch for half that. Do I fear that my signature will fade? My neighbors have planted no pines, but all have many birches. Am I snobbish about having a woodlot of distinction? The pine stays green all winter. The birch punches the clock in October. Do I favor the tree that, like myself, braves the winter wind? The pine will shelter a grouse, but the birch will feed him. Do I consider bed more important than board? The pine will ultimately bring $10 a thousand, the birch $2. Have I an eye on the bank? All of these possible reasons for my bias seem to carry some weight, but none of them carries very much. So I try again, and here perhaps is something. Under this pine will ultimately grow a trailing arbutus, an Indian pipe, a pyrola, or a twin flower, whereas under the birch, a bottle gentian is about the best to be hoped for. In this pine, a pileated woodpecker will ultimately chisel out a nest. In the birch, a hairy will have to suffice. In this pine, the wind will sing for me in April, at which time the birch is only rattling naked twigs. These possible reasons for my bias carry weight, but why? Does the pine stimulate my imagination and my hopes more deeply than the birch does? If so, is the difference in the trees or in me? The only conclusion I have ever reached is that I love all trees, but I am in love with pines. As I said, November is the month for the axe, and, as in other love affairs, there is skill in the exercise of bias. If the birch stands south of the pine and is taller, it will shade the pine's leader in the spring, and thus discourage the pine weevil from laying her eggs there. Birch competition is a minor affliction compared with this weevil, whose progeny kill the pine's leader and thus deform the tree. It is interesting to meditate that this insect's preference for squatting in the sun determines not only her own continuity as a species, but also the future figure of my pine and my own success as a wielder of axe and shovel. Again, if a droughty summer follows my removal of the birch's shade, the hotter soil may offset the lesser competition for water, and my pine be none the better for my bias. Lastly, if the birch's limbs rub the pine's terminal buds during a wind, the pine will surely be deformed, and the birch must either be removed, regardless of other considerations, or else it must be pruned of limbs each winter, to a height greater than the pine's prospective summer growth. Such are the pros and cons the wielder of an axe must foresee, compare, and decide upon with the calm assurance that his bias will, on the average, prove to be something more than good intentions. The wielder of an axe has as many biases as there are species of trees on his farm. In the course of the years, he imputes to each species, from his responses to their beauty or utility, and their responses to his labors for or against them, a series of attributes that constitute a character. I am amazed to learn what diverse characters different men impute to one and the same tree. Thus, to me, the aspen is in good repute because he glorifies October and he feeds my grouse in winter. But to some of my neighbors, he is a mere weed, perhaps because he sprouted so vigorously in the stump lots their grandfathers were attempting to clear. I cannot sneer at this, for I find myself disliking the elms whose resproutings threaten my pines. Again, the tamarack is to me a favorite second only to white pine, perhaps because he is nearly extinct in my township, underdog bias, or because he sprinkles gold.